Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Smashbox TV's podcast 448. Terry Miller, the Disc Golf Guy, along with Johnny V.
In spirit. Because you're in sunny Florida.
Sunny, sometimes muggy, usually warm and sunny Florida. Yes.
None of those things matter.
Speaking of which, nothing like leaving whenever I did, Thursday? And then just the barrage and onslaught, I think it was on Thursday or Friday already, of nothing but snow pictures and like almost a legitimate snowstorm blizzard type scenario back in Wisconsin or no?
I mean, there was a little bit of time when the wind was picked up quite a bit. It's hard to call it a blizzard when it just snows a lot. Like, to me, blizzard entails a ton of wind and whatnot. And there was a little bit of that for a while. But in general, I think right around my house, got 8 to 9 inches of snow. A little further north, a friend of ours, actually, this past weekend was the Wisconsin spring opener up in...
How'd that work out?
Ohauser Park, I think, is where it was, something along those lines. Yep. And I believe they had well over a foot of snow that was dumped in less than 24 hours. Because there was a picture I saw of a gentleman who got an ace the day before, and he's there with his disc, and you see no snow on the ground. And he shows a picture next day. He's at Tournament Central, and it's not quite white out at that point, but it was very, very touchy. They ended up calling the second round and just not bothering because the first round took so long that they were just afraid they were not going to be able to get in a second round.
I did not hear that. Yeah. Now, granted, just like our event in Texas, I didn't hear a ton of the details because I was, head, feet, neck deep, whatever, in Tallahassee. I realized that they didn't play the second round at the tournament, which makes perfect sense with all of that snow that came just the day before. Probably most people weren't expecting and or truly planned for it. And there's only so much daylight. So interesting news to hear.
I think the hardest part was, you're right, the fact that it all showed up the day before. Had it been one day earlier, everyone could have probably gotten to the tournament in a good time. They might even have pushed back the start time a little bit based on the fact that all travel was super slow throughout the entire Midwest. Especially Wisconsin, so it just took everybody longer to get there. Our buddy Steve, who went up there, said he didn't drive hardly any faster than 45 miles an hour from here up to Appleton, which normally it's 70 to 75 you're going. So it took him almost twice as long to get there. So I think everything was just pushed back a little bit. Life happens, you know. That's what you get when you do a spring opener the weekend after spring. And in Wisconsin, sometimes spring doesn't start until May.
Yeah. So. Well, okay. Well, hopefully everyone remains safe. I knew that some people just flat out couldn't make it to the event because of it. And I'm going to continue to steer clear of that event. And I know I run an event in just a few weeks myself. We could have the exact same thing in southern Wisconsin on April 15th and 16th. But it seems like that event always has the worst weather and or conditions. So yeah. I'm going to continue to steer clear of it. And I guess I'll just complain about the humidity I dealt with in Florida instead. 80 degrees, 85, no snow. All right. So tonight, for everyone that's wondering, we are going to have Sai Ananda join us. She is actually making a near cross-country trip, I believe, trying to get back and relax and get home for a little bit before she gets back out on the road. But she said she's going to take a pit stop and join us. So we appreciate that. I think we're expecting her around 9:30 Central Time, so roughly 25 minutes from now. So if you're sitting here just waiting and all you care about is hearing from her, well, you can tune out for a little bit and then make sure you rejoin us. But Sai Ananda is going to join us from the road, and we'll be able to catch up with her. And until then, we can talk about what we saw at Texas States on the MPO side, and we can also talk about what I experienced and what we had over in Tallahassee. So, Johnny, you want to start it off with MPO action down in Texas this weekend?
Nothing more that I would like to do, Terry Miller. We saw Kelvin continue to dominate. He won by 5 strokes. Oh, okay. I think he went in with a 4-stroke lead, and he picked up a stroke. The guy just is the best disc golfer on the planet right now. His putting is, for the most part, lights out. He just can't be stopped. It doesn't matter the type of course. It doesn't seem to matter the distance. Kelvin's on a heater. He's finished third, first, or something along those lines. There's
Who's no. Who do you think he is? The Kristen Tatar of previous podium finishes? Jeez.
I mean, wouldn't be nice? That'd be a season in MPO for sure.
Yeah, it certainly would be.
So Kelvin, to be fair, I didn't even watch the last round for MPO. Because it was, to me, almost so boring knowing, like, ugh, Vinny, you got this. Watch Top Chef instead. So there's that.
Wow.
That's how my interest was peaked.
Where are your priorities?
In the right place, apparently. Second place, a tie with Anthony Barella and Joel Freeman. They were 5 strokes behind Kelvin, as I said. Fourth place, the name would keep talking, other than Kelvin, James Proctor. Proctor is having a season. And he just, there's nothing stopping that guy right now. He, for those of you that didn't follow, I think we've talked about this, you know, regional player who was almost, I think he was 1040 rated for a while, went on tour, just in general, I don't think had the best touring season, and his rating dropped. It plummeted like almost 20 points. And for everyone that knows James Proctor knows that he's not a 1020 golfer. And I think we're seeing this year the type of golfer he truly is. So he was, 7 strokes behind Kelvin at 26. Fifth place, Alden Harris. Sixth place, Nicholas Antila. Tied with Ezra Aderholt. Ezra, another guy who's having a really great start to the season. I think other than Waco. Was it Waco or was it
Texas? Yeah, it was second. And I happened to just look at that, so I'll pretend like I knew that one. But yeah, that's his only poor finish out of the season, and he's sitting in what, like the top, I want to say he's in like 7th place in the Disc Golf Pro Tour standings, or maybe eventually. But yeah, he's had a really good year, except for a less than amazing finish at Waco.
And Waco, as we know, I don't want to say it's not fluky. That's not the right word to ever use with Waco. It challenges a different set of skills, and maybe that's a spot where, looking at Ezra, he knows that he needs to get a little bit better in the woods. So we'll see. Honestly.
And to give him full credit, he's sitting in third. I was looking at his finishes. He's sitting in third in the Disc Golf Pro Tour standings right now. He's got a 6th, a 6th, a 2nd, a 72nd, a 6th, and a 6th. Holy cow. So
he's consistent.
If it doesn't have a two or a 6 in it, he's not interested at this point. So yeah, holy cow. 1, 2, 3, 4 different events he's finished either 6th or tied for sixth in four out of the last six events he's played on the Disc Golf Pro Tour. So
he's probably about the sixth best rated player in the, or sixth best player in the world right now, we'll say. Not rated, but anyway, Ezra Aderholt in tied for sixth. Eighth place, we had Aaron Gossage and Kyle Klein. A good showing for Aaron Gossage, who has not really been in the conversation much yet this year. And I would say a disappointing finish for Kyle Klein, who has been a lot in our conversation as he just won Waco and has finished well most of the events. So for him to kind of, and it's only eighth place, it's a silver series, a silver event, not silver series, it's a silver event. But ultimately, I think Kyle probably, most people expected maybe a little bit higher finish from Kyle. A 10th place was Brody Smith, which is, again, a really good finish for him. He, you know, he took a 7 on a par 5 where a lot of people were taking birdie on that. And that literally knocked him out of, you know, fifth or sixth place. So Brody having a really good event. I think we're going to see still with Brody a little bit of up and down play. I think that's just, it's, he's still relatively fresh, I will say, on the scene, and he's still kind of getting a skill set together. Tied with Chris Clemens, Clemenade, shot a 20 under. That's your top 10 right there, Jerry.
Okay. I mean, any wild surprises when we're looking at that top 10? Is there anything that like absolutely blows your mind?
No. Honestly, I mean, as I said, I think Kyle Klein probably a little disappointed in an eighth just based on how he's been playing lately. You would have thought he would have been fighting for a podium spot, but anyone can have an off weekend. It's a silver event. I think the big surprise is who didn't finish in the top 10, and that is Gannon Burr. Gannon took 19th, tied 19th with Gavin Babcock. Well,
yeah, it kind of looks like he took the back nine off is what he did. I'm going to preface this and say this, hopefully just this once. I consumed none, and maybe Caster, I consumed none of the event this weekend as it was taking place in Texas. Obviously, all of my attention was focused on getting the coverage post-release over there in Tallahassee. So outside of barely 2 seconds of flipping through a Facebook or a Reddit or whatever, I saw a couple headlines. I saw an own ace. Outside of that, I saw almost nothing. But just real quick, and looking at Gannon's finish to the event, from hole 8 to hole 18, where you see a ton of blue birdies on UU disc, we see that there was just one single birdie by Burr. And so it kind of looked like something either happened or he just took the back nine off or whatever, but clearly did not finish as strong as most of the field did.
Yeah, the back nine is a spot where you can score. There's two spots where I think Gannon failed. It was round one, the front nine, where he was like 4 or 5 over par on the front nine round one. Okay. And it was windy that first day, very, very tough conditions. But he did not perform nearly as well as I think a lot of people predicted. And then you're right, the third round of the back nine. Nothing wrong with the second round where he shot a 10 under, clearly. It was that first round where he shot a 1 down, and then the third round where he shot a 4 down. Just a bad event for Gannon. I mean,
sure,
it's
now
not much you can say.
And I'm
going to
lean
it
on you for this. I know everything I just said about not watching, so I'll lean on you for this. Talk about the course, because this is an event that traditionally has that rotates. It's essentially bid out for Texas States, then rotates from place to place. Last year, we saw it at a totally different location, different tournament directors, all of that. Talk about what we saw for the course, or what your takeaways were from the course out there.
The course, I thought it was a decent course for MPO. I don't think it was much of anything special. For MPO.
Okay.
It's about 9,800 feet, almost 9,900 feet, actually. So a relatively average length course for our Pro Tour series. And it's a temp course. It's not, it's not in the ground all the time, unlike the FPO, which is more or less a modified version of, I think, Brock Park. So this is what they call Brock Park Gold. The MPO and the FPO had two completely different courses. So,
which is pretty phenomenal. Unique in itself, right?
Yeah, I think, and I hate to stereotype, But a lot of courses that are put in the ground for most parks and we'll say slightly upper level events are probably catered better towards our FPO players just based on distances. The MPO players will go to most of your local parks and shred them. So they need different challenges. So the FPO course was, I thought it was tuned a little bit. Clearly it wasn't exactly what the park had is laid out as, but it was really good for them. There was really good scoring. I think we saw a bunch of six, seven, eight under pars, really scoreable. And it was obviously scoreable as well for the men, but I didn't find the men's course as compelling, maybe. And maybe that's part of it that it was the fact that Kelvin was crushing. Like, he kind of got out and just never, and so maybe I lost a little bit of interest and my thoughts wandered and I don't know, all the other things. But I didn't love the men's course. I did love the FPO course. But I will say that there's a lot of people maybe paid a little bit more attention than I did to MPO that felt that this set of courses should be a staple on the tour. Maybe every other year or something along those lines. Houston had a really great turnout for spectators for a silver event. And I know there's talk about how much time we spend in Texas, but looking at Waco, looking at Austin, looking at Houston, they all pulled in really good amounts of spectators. If you can get that every year or two, I don't see why we need to wander away from Texas with two elite events and a silver event.
I would generically rebut that by saying I think there's something to be said about just being in a different state, even, and I'll just make up a silly scenario. Even if the exact course you played in northern Texas looks just the course you play in southern Oklahoma, I just think there's this idea of, hey, we're at a different place, we're in a different location, therefore it feels different. And so for our players to be in Texas for three straight weeks, where you could flip a coin as to what you're going to get in terms of the weather at this time of year, I think there's just and I'm only speaking from the rumor mill, there's just a lack of appeal to that. And that's not to be a rip on Texas or any of these amazing clubs and sponsors. Of course, none of that. But there is kind of this notion of like, I don't want to be in the same state as big as it is. I don't want to be in the same state 3 weeks in a row. We might think that's silly, but that's what the players are saying.
I agree. And obviously it depends on the time of year and what's going on, because the only other place I feel like we can be is Florida. You know, I guess you could go back to Arizona, but even anything north of Texas, you run the risk of snow.
Sure.
I mean,
there's phenomenal golf in Louisiana down there. And of course, I know people have to put in bids, blah, 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 and have to want to hold events. I mean, there's other places that could get played. But I also agree. I mean, obviously the schedule locks in to be a logical place. Like you said, if you're getting good turnouts, you're getting people that want to run large scale events. And if Texas happens to be that home, that's great. I feel like our players have this notion of like, I don't know if I want 3 weeks there.
I can understand that. I believe we saw some players skip out on the silver event. People that were signed up that just decided not to show. You know, KJ bailed. Matty O kind of bailed. He was registered. Matty O was registered for two events this weekend. And part of that might just be part of the tour card. You register and you have... Hey, there you go. So you're getting in anyway. So I answered quite a few questions on Skip Ace about where Matty O was. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure he's doing Tallahassee. And we were right. He did Tallahassee. I think if you put the silver event between the two elite, it might force the players to stay. I don't know if that's what you want. And again, we've seen that sometimes it might be better for interest, for spectators, for fundraising to make this an every other year event. in Houston. Yep. We'll say just in Houston, because we saw last year when the tour stayed in Texas for this long, the final Texas event had mediocre spectatorship. It seemed to lack a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, I feel like it was different this time around, but who knows what you're going to get next year. If Texas States is in Dallas next year, you might not get that. Who knows? It's a really tough call.
As in, like I said, it always starts with you have to have event organizers, partners that want to be putting on an event. So it's all got to start there. We can say pie in the sky ideas and woulda, coulda, shouldas all day long, but it starts with events and organizers that want to put on an event. That's got to be the starting point. And then the pro tour has now, I'll call it a luxury, of being able to pick or choose where they want to be and who they're going to partner up with to have an event in any given location. I mean, some of these are good problems to have, so to speak, that we have these choices, we have these opportunities. But I'm just relaying a little of what I hear out on the ground, which is...
Yeah. You know, it's not a secret.
Somebody said it perfectly on the board. Someone said, well, but 3 weeks in Oregon has a different vibe, a different feel to it. I'm not anti-Texas by any means, but if you polled a lot of people, especially disc golfers, nature loving disc golfers, and you said, would you like 3 weeks in Oregon or would you like 3 weeks in Texas? I feel like a lot of the poll is going to come back for Oregon. Oregon's just one of the most beautiful places to be. Now, way more expensive and has a lot of other perceived cons to it. But let's face it, that's not even – I still don't think that's going to be a fair question as to where you'd rather spend 3 weeks for most of our disc golf community. Fair or not, that's just a reality. So.
Let's move over to FPO discussion. As I said, the course was tuned really nicely for the FPO. I felt it was very scoreable. Sayananda, our guest tonight, once she finds a spot to settle up, she won, beating Kristen Tatar by 3 strokes. A very solid win for Sai. Sai went into the round, I believe, with a 4-stroke lead. Oh, I think actually it was... It was like 3 strokes over Owen, but 4 over Kristen, and then there was some shuffling. So either way, she ends up with a 3-stroke victory over Kristen Tatar. Third place, Owen Scoggins with a 16 under par, so losing to Sai by 4 strokes. Holland Hanley in fourth place. Fifth place, a tie with Katrina Allen and Jessica Weiss. Seventh place, Missy Gannon. Eighth place, Kat Murch and Aria Castorita. And running off the top 10, Emily Beach. I know this is a silver event, but one thing that I'll say is that this had basically every person other than Paige Pierce at it for your major FPO players. It did lack your Henna and Evelina, but Henna and Evelina haven't necessarily been in the conversation this year yet. Off and on. I think this is a course where Henna could have really excelled. She might have taken a podium here, or maybe a top 5 at worst, depending on how things are going. But regardless of all of that, Sayananda handily beat the field. And you could tell by watching Kristen Tatar play, there's something off with Kristen's game. Whether it's her putting, her approaching... She's just leaving herself with longer putts inside the circle and missing them. And I think that she has talked about it on her social media, how something is just something's not sitting right with her right now in her game. And she has flown now back over to Estonia to take care of some personal things for a week or so. And then she flies back for Music City. And then she's going to go Music City. She might be playing the silver after that and then right to Champions Cup.
Oh, there is a silver event after that? Or is it a week? I think there's a week off. Actually, I think there is a week off because I think it goes Music City and then the 15th and 16th. I thought we had a possibly even a weekend. Oh, no, I apologize. I apologize. Innova Blue Ridge Championship at North Cove.
North Cove.
Yeah, so that happens. And then this cup. And then, of course, Jonesboro. Obviously, she's defending champion at both Champions Cup. Not at Champions Cup, as I just said, she won the major. She didn't. She's so close. But obviously, runner up at Champions Cup last year. And then she went on and destroyed everybody at Jonesboro the week after. So we'll see her at those. Did you say if she is registered?
She is registered for the Blue Ridge Championship. It makes sense.
She's registered.
Usually when we see our overseas competitors come over, they tend to play almost all the events. It makes sense to get them in.
Yeah, well, you're here.
I mean,
yeah, you're here to play golf.
She's one of the ones that could take a week off, and it wouldn't hurt or bother her, as opposed to maybe some of the other players who, when they come over, they want to get in as much golf as humanly possible against the top competitors. So Onskoggins gets an ace on the first round, a skip ace on hole two, I believe it was.
Does she owe you royalties for that?
She does, actually. I know. I think I have to pay her. I think that's how that works, because I have skipace.com, so I need to pay her something. So we'll figure that out. But anyway, Onskoggins, a pretty solid round or event in that matter. Again, like I said, taking third, just very, very own. Very own-esque, I will say, this event. And watching, it was fun. I watched all of the FPO this weekend. Watching the interactions between Cy, Kristen, and Own was enjoyable. They were having so much fun, always rooting for each other. It felt like almost every single great shot was awarded, like, knucks by everyone in the card. At one point, Cy and Own are looking for four leaf clovers wandering around. It's such a different vibe than we get with MPO. For every star frame they got, star birdie, we'll say, they'd all go up to the chains and shake the chains together. It was a funny.
Yeah,
like,
that's. It's a, it, yeah, it's I think been that's a European thing, right?
Or yeah, it's been around for a little while, but I haven't seen other groups do that, and I know Kristen's been in quite a few of them, but this one, they were doing that as well, and it was a fun event to watch. Cy kind of had it, I don't want to say she had it handily, because towards the middle of that final round, it got a little bit sketch for her when Own birdied two holes and then took a bogey, and Cy bogeyed two holes. So it kind of got a little bit where things could get out of hand, but Cy buckled down. She got three birdies in a row, 12, 13, and 14 on the final round, followed it up with three pars, one of which she played masterfully, just laid it up. There's OB. It's a hole that pushes out to almost like a peninsula. It's OB on both sides. Tatar went for it. And because she had birdied the previous hole on 17, threw it out of bounds. Sayananda, I believe, went next. Guys, it's getting blurry now. Laid it up way short, like way short of the thing. This is a 297 foot hole. I think Sai threw it 160 feet, 180 feet maybe. And then Own went for it as well for the peninsula and went out of bounds. Holland Hanley went for it, went out of bounds. I believe Holland hit the OB putt, though. The other two did not. And Cy had a scary 150-foot approach, 140-foot approach into this little island, but she just threw something, a nice stable mid-range, put it right on the island and tapped it in on 17. When then she went to 18, made the water, and then drained an unnecessary birdie putt. We'll say that. But she's shaking her head. She's in our green room right now. She just showed up in the digital green room, and she kind of nods her head like she knows. So, we're talking about her. Let's just let's bring her onto the show. So I'd like to welcome Sayananda to the Smashbox TV podcast. I can spit this
Hello,
out.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing?
Thank you. I'm doing really well. I'm coming at you from the streets of Denver right now.
Hopefully someplace safe.
Yes, yes.
Right. Well, thank you. I told everyone at the top of the show that you'd be joining us, Ralph. So also that you're traveling, right? You're trying to get home for a little rest and relaxation, or what? What's kind of, we don't need your coordinates for any weirdos out there, but what are you doing?
I had from Houston, I think it was a 29-hour drive, I want to say, back home. So we busted out a one leg of it yesterday, and then we're trying to maybe drive through the night tonight because we're very eager to get home. My dad and I.
All right. I did not realize that. So thank you even more so for taking a little time to join us. So we won't keep you long like a normal show. But presumably this was all in your plan of your touring and going home after this event and so on and so forth. Nothing's changed with all this newfound championship victory and anything.
It's kind of funny how as soon as I kind of like got the trophy and signed awards and stuff like that. It was like, oh, the card behind you, you're going to need to get off the hole. There's still cards playing. And then, I need to get home so I can pack all of my Airbnb so I can pack all of my stuff. And then it's humorous how much life goes on, you know, after such a momentous kind of like, you know, day and such a momentous, you know, week with all the practice days leading up to it and all of this anticipation, and then all of a sudden, oop, you know, 15 minutes and you're in tears, and then all of a sudden, oh, I have to get home. I have to pack everything. I have to prepare for the next event, lodging for the next event. And it's funny how life just kind of moves forward.
Is there a little bit of disappointment in that you're not continuing your hot streak? That now you have to kind of take this break. A lot of the tour is going east, and obviously you're going west and going to kind of wait for the west, you know, the west coast swing to come and hit you. But is there a little bit of disappointment that you're like, I'm not going to go to MCO, I'm not going to hit Champions Cup? You know, it just feels like there's a lot of momentum behind you right now.
Honestly, it's kind of the contrary. I feel like that was such a big, like, kind of blow up, you know, that was emotionally, that was so huge for me. And then physically just kind of like being on the road for the last, you know, five, almost 6 weeks, it's actually kind of relieving and actually really nice to have this big, you know, like, emotional kind of like explosion, I guess, to say. And then I get to, instead of just racing off to the next event or, you know, racing off to the next course to practice, I get to kind of go home and I get to kind of sit on it for a little while. And even now it's still kind of sinking in that actually happened. And the public definitely helps it sink in. Just the absolute I think onslaught is a pretty accurate word of just joy and support and encouragement. And like, I literally haven't even had time to scroll through all of the messages and all of the comments and all of the posts of just congratulatory, you know, just support. And it's honestly, it's really nice just to be able to go home and to kind of rest and to, you know, catch up on all of that, you know, maybe spend a day on social media, you know, kind of connecting with people who are supporting and, you know, replying to all those messages and stuff like that. So I guess you could see it as maybe disappointing, but I think it was an absolute perfect kind of crescendo a little bit. And now I get to kind of rest and prepare myself for my next leg.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like a walk-off, you know, like, psh, ah, I'm champ, I'm out. I'll see you guys later. I'll rejoin you.
Yes.
Now, speaking of your schedule, according to the PDGA at least, your next event isn't until Masters Cup in the beginning of May, May 5th, and then it looks like you're playing almost every single weekend in May and June for the most part. Is that truly going to be your next event? And what will you do between now and Masters Cup?
Honestly, I don't really have anything lined up. So Masters Cup is going to be, the next event that I plan on doing. And honestly, if I get back home tomorrow, I think it'll be maybe 3.5 weeks I have to kind of, you know, relax at home, recuperate and switch up my wardrobe for kind of a warmer stretch. I definitely have a lot of pants and socks and boots and jackets for, you know, Texas. So, I'm kind of just planning on doing, at least a little bit of rest, you know, a little bit of recuperation, spend some quality time with my cat and my boyfriend. And, I think I have a team back home, that I kind of go to putting with and just kind of, or putting league with and stuff like that. So I have a group back home that is so eager to see me, and I'm probably planning on playing a couple putting leagues if I can make it out there and kind of connect with some of my fans back at home and my friends back at home. They want to take me out to a big celebratory dinner and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be a really nice break to kind of recharge myself a little bit and kind of refocus, and then hopefully I can get some putting league practice. And I think there's I'm sure you guys have heard of Caliber Disc Golf Course. I think it's like the top six, you know, one of the best courses, and that's about an hour away from where I live. So I think the plan is to quality time with boyfriend, maybe some putting league, and maybe go hit the, you know, sixth best course in the whole world to keep my skills, you know, at the tippy top.
Now you,
sounds plan.
So now, there's a kind of a saying that we tend to use in disc golf where you need to learn how to win, but this is really your first opportunity in the pro tour, at least, to win. But you've had success in other avenues, so to speak. You won Am Worlds here in Wisconsin. You were in Madison, Wisconsin. That's probably the first place I remember seeing you and hearing your name, watching your game, thinking like, I think she can be pretty good at some point. And from there you dropped off. I've listened to a few other interviews with you, and so I kind of have a general idea of, you know, kind of some of the things that happened between then and now, as far as, you know, you having to kind of regather your life, we'll say, after some financial issues that you ran into. How does this win compare to the Am Worlds win? Like, both of which were extremely exciting.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, it's kind of hard to compare because the Am Worlds win and this win kind of happened to different size. You know what I mean? Like back then, that was, I don't know, similar, but different, because both wins are, they mean so much to me. Both wins, I think, are and were kind of pivot points in my career. So winning that Am Worlds in 2016, that was the kind of the catalyst for my pro career. You know, that was the, I'm sure I could have gone pro, you know, before then, but for me, that was like a kind of a, like cinching it and wrapping it up with a bow. Like I have accomplished almost everything that you could hope to accomplish as an amateur player. You know, an amateur world title is probably one of the highest things that you can accomplish, you know, without playing professionally. So that was like a really huge kind of like sign off for my amateur career and to move forward into the next chapter in my pro career. And so I think there's a little bit of similarity in the fact that this is also really pivotal for me, being my first win since going on tour officially, and my biggest success with West Side Discs. And I think it's, I don't know, it feels similarly incredible, but I think this has a lot more, like a lot more power to it, you know. Now, like, it's kind of been unreal the last couple of days, just to kind of feel that, I mean, I don't want to say fame, but kind of, you know what I mean? All of a sudden my name is like in the limelight, and there are so many disc golf media outlets that are talking about my statistics, or, you know, that crazy putt that I ran. And we can get into that, 'cause it's a funny story. And so I think, I don't know, I think this is really powerful. I think this is really huge and really powerful for me. And I think I'm really hoping that I'm setting myself up for just an amazing year. And honestly, if this is the biggest success that I have this season, I've already reached and surpassed some of the, albeit modest, goals that I have had for this season. You know, like, I want to cash at some, you know, as many events as possible. Top tens are super amazing. Top fives are super amazing. I've gotten an ace this year. I've gotten a couple thousand rated rounds, which is amazing. I've got a few amazing bogey-free streaks, which I'm kind of proud to be known for. I've got the Sai Par Ananda, so pars pars mean a lot to me. Pars make the birdies count. So this win is just, it's so huge for me. I think on so many different tiers and so many different levels that I'm still even kind of realizing, you know, like what this win actually means looking forward into the future, and just kind of like for the future of my career and my personal life. Like this could be, I think, and I guess maybe to summarize, AM Worlds was an incredible accomplishment, but I think this win, even just a Silver Series win, I think is life changing. For me, I want to say this is going to kind of change the coordinates, change the direction that my life is going. And I think it's just so incredible.
We saw Westside released a support disc congratulating you. Is that still available? I was looking on the website. I didn't quite get a chance to finish poking around out there. Is that available that people can still support you and pick up a disc?
Yes. A little bit of a plug. If you follow me on Instagram at Sai Par Ananda, there is a link in my bio that will take you to the page. And, on that note, it was kind of incredible. As you may know, I was with Latitude 64 for almost 7 years. And I move over to Westside. And so Westside released this tournament warship to celebrate my victory. And incredibly enough, Latitude 64 decided that they wanted to share in that victory and kind of share their support. So they have actually released the disc overseas in Europe as well as the United States, which is like super huge. I don't think any other Trilogy player has done that before. So you can find it at Latitude 64 CE, and you can find it at Dynamic Discs as well as Westside.com.
Well, I heard that's why House of Discs ended up buying Dynamic, just to keep you on the team, right? They saw you move over to Westside, and they were like, we can't let her go. We'll buy your whole team. So
yes, just
yeah, you are a major bargaining. Yeah, major bargaining chip and all that, which is awesome. So let's talk about, you just said, you know, that particular putt, and maybe before you dial into that specific decision making, just talk about your game this weekend. And was it any different than previous weekends, or what was the difference, if any, in terms of how this weekend went down for you compared to some of your previous outings this year? Like, what was the difference?
Well, I think this is going to be a really big year for me in like learning experiences. You know, I've obviously played a handful of bigger events and elite series and majors and stuff like that, but I don't think it really compares to how saturated I think your experiences become in disc golf when you are playing, you know, every weekend for, you know, whatever period of time that is. And so I'm really trying to absorb as much as I can from each event and just learn as much as possible, because one of my, you know, Achilles heels, as I think, has always just been my experience. You know, I've always kind of had the skills, you know, the distance and the putts and the accuracy and stuff like that, but competitors have always kind of had the edge on me from the experience, whether it be just experience throwing on different courses and having a more diverse disc selection, or having the ability to kind of scramble in a different way, or mental experience, you know, just having gone through those experiences so many times, your thought processes are a little bit different. So I would say that my practice and my focus and my intention for each event has kind of changed as they move forward. Looking back at Las Vegas kind of and Waco, there was definitely a different level of like hole analysis and strategy. So I think that showed in the amount of OB strokes that I got. And it could have been just kind of the way the courses were playing for me. It's kind of hard to say whether it's, you know, correlation or causation and stuff like that. But my OB strokes, I think, really took me out of throwing and playing successful rounds in Vegas and Waco, because I would finish the round thinking, wow, I played pretty decent. You know, maybe it wasn't incredible, but I played pretty good. And then I would look at my scores at the end of the day and realize, okay, yeah, I did, you know, the amount of shots that I threw were pretty good, but the penalty strokes on top of that kind of didn't reflect how I felt about my play. So that was a big learning experience there, in just kind of managing that kind of throttle between like going for an aggressive play or sticking with a conservative strategy and taking the bird in the hand rather than the, you know, two in the bush and stuff like that. So I tried to make a couple adjustments as I moved into Waco, and I think I made some improvements there, but the finish at Waco was super duper rough for me. And I kind of wasn't able to manage my OB strokes again that weekend. And so when I went to Austin, it was definitely kind of first and foremost, don't go OB. And then you can kind of build on top of that. And then, so like first and foremost, have that conservative strategy, and then you can toggle from there and kind of make conscious decisions on where you want to take your birdies, or, you know, take those strokes that you can. And I think that showed that focus that I decided to apply, I think showed in Austin. And then I obviously had a really great bogey free round there, and did really, really well on OBs. So that was a huge learning experience. And then I think I took that learning experience going from Waco to Austin and applied it to this event. And the course, the B-Rock mod, wasn't so tight with the OBs, and the ground wasn't super duper skippy, but there were definitely a factor in your aggressive play, and whether it's worth going for that extra 50 to 70 feet of distance to maybe put yourself in a position for three, or you could try and give yourself that extra 50 to 70 feet and, you know, flare out of bounds and end up taking unnecessary strokes. So that, I think, managing OBs and managing that toggle between aggressive and conservative play was a huge learning lesson just in these last four events. And I'm hoping that I can kind of take that and apply that to the rest of my season, as well as kind of just learn from each new course that I end up playing and really try and kind of carve myself as a golfer and just take in as much as I possibly can, kind of.
So let's talk about hole 17 and 18 to finish out the round. I kind of described it on 17. Did you mean to lay up that short? Was that your plan right in front of that tree? Because it felt like you only cut off about half of that hole when I felt you could have been a little bit more aggressive.
So right in front of that tree, I definitely wanted to be maybe 15, 20 in front of that tree. It was probably hard to see, but I ended up releasing probably 5-10 degrees to the right more than I wanted to for some reason. And so I got caught up in these little branches that were kind of dangling me down, and then it pushed me and slowed the disc down into right in front of that tree. I mean, I definitely wouldn't choose to have an awkward patent pending yeah. right behind a tree in my strategy. So that I don't think I played that hole well the entire weekend. I don't think I had maybe round one. I had a solid a solid drive on that, but I was playing that hole for par 100%. In my mind, with my skill set, I didn't think that it was I'm backhand dominant, and I just didn't think that the backhand line was worth having to putt for par if I went out of bounds I guess I kind of play my head and my emotions a little bit. So if I think that a shot is going to be too risky and then it's going to cause like an emotional flare, I don't really need to play something that's worth a stroke but could cause me a stroke later on just because it kind of frazzled me missing a putt or missing a shot or something like that. So my game plan for that hole was definitely to play for par, but on rounds 2 and 3, absolutely did not execute the drive the way I intended to. And then I guess to rewind just a little bit to hole 16, Kristen Tatar made the only birdie on that hole. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, in my mind, that was a really huge and pivotal moment. Just going into that final stretch to have her have the solo birdie and kind of just creep that one shot closer going into 17 was super duper huge and potentially could have played a factor, I think, in my nerves and me kind of having that little error on that tee shot, honestly.
So then talk a little bit about 18, because you perfected the shot with the, as you're saying, the patent pending on 17, which was a very difficult approach, but then you have to go into 18, a water carry with some protective trees, OB all along the outside. It's not extremely long. Is it what, two? I think it was 280, 272. Run us kind of through what you're thinking on 18, because at this point, everyone at home knows you have about a two or three stroke lead.
Yeah. So playing for that par on 17 felt amazing, especially since, I think you were talking about it earlier, since everybody else went OB on that card and I was able to really maintain. So that was kind of you slipped up off the tee, but you were able to rein it in and keep it together. And there was definitely a lot of nerves going into 18. Like you said, it's just short hole and it's should be a pretty stock shot. You throw it straight, have it hyzer into the green. Nothing super duper complicated. There's a few little bushes in there that I ended up getting caught up on in round 2. But going to that hole, I hadn't checked scores at all. Kind of going into the round, I just told myself that I'm going to execute the shots that I know that I can execute the shots that I know that are within my skill set, within my range, that I know that I can accomplish, and whatever happens. You know, may the best player win. I'm going to play my best game, and I know they are, and whatever happens on the final putt of hole 18, I am going to be absolutely elated, not only for my performance, but for the performance of my competitor. So moving into 18, I really just kind of tried to clear my mind of any kind of excessive thought like that and just focus on, you know, throw the disc straight, hit your line, don't go too far. because you don't really want to make the green and then go swoosh and skip past it, you know, onto the sidewalk, even though that's, you know, a pretty easy comebacker for par. But basically my thoughts going into this were just kind of like, keep it together, you know, one last hole, just keep it together one shot at a time. Don't overthink it, execute those shots. So moving into 18, I can't remember who had the box, but after everyone teed off, you know, I landed in bounds. I want to say everyone landed in bounds, if not in the circle, on that last shot. So after Kristen made it, cause I didn't know scores, but I knew kind of in my heart and kind of in the back of my mind.
You had the box, by the way. You let off on that. Okay. Round.
Yeah. I had to lead that off. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely intimidating. So after Kristen made it inbounds, I thought she had made it closer, cause I came up kind of short and I was just, you know, on the front of that little embankment basically there. So after everybody teed off and we're walking to the basket, I decided that that was the moment when I wanted to check scores and know if I needed to lay it up or if I needed to run it, or just I needed to give myself that information to know how to kind of play it moving forward. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if I just had like panic brain and I was looking at the round total, not the overall total. But for some reason, I thought that I only had a one stroke lead on her going into that hole. And so, yeah, you kind of see where this little was going.
Because
here,
I think with a three stroke lead, off the tee, even I attacked that hole differently. Like the way you drove, it was, I want to say it was tentative, but you made it over the water and you kind of landed there on the front bank with a three stroke lead. Me personally, I throw that disc as hard as I can, clear the water, clear the trees, clear the road. I'm OB on the other side, knowing that I could easily take a four and win. But when you laid up and made it over, I was like, oh, that's a different approach, but awesome. Go for it.
Because I was just apparently in my own little world of panic, basically. And so I'm thinking, okay, she's inside the circle and she's closer than me. And if she makes this putt, she could tie us and move to a playoff. And Lord, I do not want to play off against this incredibly skilled and experienced player, just a phenomenal player. So that was fear, pure fear. And so I'm thinking, I got to make this to secure the win. I have to make this
putt
to close the door. It was just outside of circle. So I want to say it was like 35.
Okay. Yeah. You just got it at 38. So I couldn't tell based on where you were, but yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty close. I think I could see one of the little orange tufties that was just like right in front of my lie. So yeah, that was kind of the thought process of like, oh my gosh. Oh my goodness gracious. She's closer than me. Ooh, no, I cannot let this go to a playoff. So I, instead of trying to, In my own scenario, instead of going into a playoff and giving her another opportunity, because if I give her an opportunity, I have every belief in the world that she has the capability of taking that opportunity. So, yeah, that was panic. That was do or die. Well, you basically.
Yeah, well, and you did it. You drained a 35-foot putt for the win over the best players in the world. That has to be good.
And just,
I mean, there's one thing to lay it up. The smart move, as everyone says, the pro moves, lay it up, drop it in, because you don't want to hit and roll and go be deep and then panic and miss the comeback and end up tying it and looking foolish, any of that. But you, under what you thought was immense pressure, you dropped in a 35 footer. That has to feel great. Like knowing that you have that in you.
I definitely did that. And I don't know. Part of me has always believed that I, you know, have that in me. I, in the past have kind of made a handful of pretty clutch putts like that. One huge moment for me was a big A-tier win at the United States Women's Rocky Mountain Disc Golf Championships. And Sarah Hokum had traveled to that event, and she was basically the big player in the field. And it was honestly a really incredible story and an incredible event to share with her. Sarah and I ended up tying the first round, the second round, and the third round, tying completely to go into a playoff. And I throw my shot, and I'm probably edge of circle two. And Sarah throws her shot, and it's a 20-foot putt. So in a playoff, I'm first to putt, and she's 20 feet away from the basket. And somehow, with just the most raw willpower I could possibly channel, I canned like a 65-foot putt. And she was looking at that 20-foot putt to carry us to the next hole. And somehow by the grace of the universe had missed that 20-foot putt and got me the win. So I knew that I had it in me, and that was kind of what was going through my head as I was lining up that putt is, man, you've been putting pretty good. You should definitely try, you know, in my own scenario of having to make it for the win, you know, believe in yourself and place a bet, you know, place a bet and swing that putt and see if you win that bet. And I won that bet.
So I have to ask, you're traveling with Dad, right? This trip, but I didn't see him on the bag. You would think that maybe having a caddy would be useful, especially maybe some of the conditions that we saw this weekend. Is that not your style? Would you rather carry your own bag, or was he busy playing? I'm not even sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it kind of is my style to carry my bag. I have the Latitude 64 Easy Go. So it's a pretty lightweight bag, even if it's full of, you know, water and drinks and everything. So the main thing is he carries everything extra. So I don't have to fill my bag and carry a 50-pound backpack. So I can roll light and just carry my discs and carry my bare necessities. And then he carries, you know, spare discs, jackets, extra towels, snacks, umbrella. Yeah, umbrella. So I kind of carry my discs and water and kind of my bare necessities. And then he's there for anything else that I could possibly need, or if I throw a disc OB and I don't have time to retrieve it, I can always send him back to go grab a disc, which is super duper helpful.
Getting the water pops.
Kind of, yeah, he helps me with, you know, everything other than my discs. And he isn't playing. He's just kind of, he's there to quote unquote caddy for me and kind of support me, help with driving and stuff like that. And so, yeah, he's the caddy that carries everything but the bag.
Then my last question I can think of right now off the top of my head regarding Texas State is round three. And we don't normally talk about outfits in general, but the shirt you wore, was that more logistical for the conditions, or is that more stylish? Because I noticed you were the only one. You don't see people wear that type of sleeveless shirt very often. And all I thought when I saw you on the first tee was, God, that's brilliant, because it's kind of rainy. You know, I hate it when sleeves get stuck on my arms and whatnot. I'm like, or is she just trying to intimidate everyone with a gun show? I don't know. What is she trying to do?
Totally. Well, it was a little bit of both. I love fashion and I love expressing myself through, you know, my style and through my clothing. And that's something that I really enjoy just like as a person. But it was also for functional reasons. I decided to wear the leggings in case I needed to pull on rain pants and wear something waterproof. And then it was also probably like 75, almost 80 degrees. Like it was haw. And so that was kind of the, I wanted to be able to layer down and not, kind of like you said, not get that like soggy sweats, basically. So it's raining, I don't need to be sweaty and raining, essentially. So that was definitely, I mean, the little wrap around my leg, purely style points, purely super.
It is, because I wasn't sure if it was one of those tendon wraps that some people wear under their knees or on their arms, but it's, so that's just all, okay, stylish. Not bad. Somebody asked me just about it. They're like, do you know if that, and I said, well, it looks like one of those straps that you put on your leg for knee issues, but now I know it's just stylish. All right.
Yep. Pure. It's like a handkerchief, pure stylish expression.
Cause I've seen you wear handkerchiefs around your neck in the past before. That was always like kind of like a stylish thing. That's the image that I have of you a lot from U.S. women's last year in general and other places, but it made me think of last year U.S. women's. The big talk about you was, just like you said, how few bogeys you took. You went all, I think there's five rounds, and didn't take a bogey until like hole 16 or something on the final round. You were in contention for that up until, you know, at that point. It would have been tough. I think you were just a few strokes out of it, but you were right there in the talks for top two or three. It was kind of amazing.
Yes, that was just incredible. And I think, I mean, I guess just a little bit of insight. I think my clean golf is always kind of what has helped me kind of place and get the scores that I can. So I'm really hoping that this year I can not only maintain that safe strategy and maintain that par golf, but I think this year is really where I want to push my comfort zone into that more aggressive kind of elite level play that you see from so many of the women out there who are fearless with a driver and run some crazy shots and just go for that extra distance. So I guess just a little like dog ears. That's something I love, my consistent play. You know, it obviously Sai Parananda is my tag on Instagram. I play for the pars, and I know that if I keep it clean, the birdies will come. And that's definitely like a huge part of my strategy, but I definitely want to get better at that more aggressive side.
So you've played and beaten now the best women in the world. Where do you put yourself?
Mind-blowing.
Yeah, well, not really. I've watched you play. You have a phenomenal putt. You have really good golf distance, and you're just very consistent. So when you look at the field and you look at yourself, do you kind of, where do you place yourself? Or when you look at the, or maybe a better question is, when you look at those other women and you say, where can I improve my game so I can be as good as them?
Well, I don't know. I guess I just kind of, I come from a humble background where, you know, I've never really, I mean, of course I think highly of myself and, you know, I know that I have skills, but that's definitely, I'm in a transition where I'm kind of going from thinking I'm the new pro, you know, on the block. I'm kind of I'm a budding pro that still has some experience and still has things to learn. And it's kind of, it's internally a little bit of a transition for me to kind of realize that I'm not just competing with the top females in the sport. I am actually participating as one of the top females in the sport. So it's kind of been interesting to watch that view of myself kind of shift a little bit and kind of move towards, you know, seeing myself as that top level athlete rather than regarding myself as, you know, as they are the top level pros and then I'm kind of the one who's coming in and stepping into it. So I think this win is definitely helping shape that view of myself and kind of regarding myself as one of the top level, you know, females. I'm not sure where my ranking is at the moment. I'm not really sure where a 949 rating would kind of place me in the world right now, but I'd want to say maybe top 30 or something like that. Top 40, I'd want to say. So I have so much room to grow. I really in my heart and in my mind, I don't think that I'm even close to plateauing just in regards to my skill and development and my mentality and my strategy. I really think that this year and the challenges that I face in playing not only elite level courses, but playing these elite level courses for the first time, I'm really, really looking forward to seeing how this year and competing with these phenomenal professional athletes is going to shape me moving on to 2024, because I definitely want to do more and better moving into 2024.
With that, you know, the board has said it. I think Johnny has kind of alluded to it, that this course seemed like it was universally loved by spectators. And I know you're going to probably have a little bit of a bias because, of course, you won on it. But what did you think of the course? And maybe you can separate yourself from winning it, or maybe not. But when you reflect back on this course, how it played to either your game or just in general for the FPO field, is this a course you'd love to return to? Or is this a course where you're like, I played it, I won, but I'm ready to get on to the next course? Like, how do you kind of reflect on the course itself that seemed to be so beloved by the viewers?
Well, I think it was definitely refreshing. I think considering the courses that we've played so far in the season in just in terms of like scoreability and playability, I think it was one of the more fun courses. I do have to say that I think the Beast was probably my favorite course so far that I've played.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed it. I think it was, I enjoyed it with a little asterisk. You know, I think it was very similar to courses that I've played in the past where I come from. It's usually pretty flat. You know, not a lot of elevation change, but a lot of trees to kind of shape the fairways. So I was feeling really, really at home with a lot of the tee shots and a lot of the approach shots, just kind of comparing them to courses that I play back home. So I think the course definitely suited my skill set. And I guess that's easy to say since I did play so well on it. I may tell a different story it may have told a different story had I, you know, shot 12 over on every round or something like that. But I think that it played very well to my skill set. It had open greens, which allowed me to approach and putt really well, which is something I practice quite a lot, you know, about 150 feet to 30 feet. And then inside the circle is where I practice quite a lot. And then I guess, like you said, golf distance, you know, I'm not really going to blow anyone away with the amount of distance that I have, but I do also have the ability to throw anything between a 300 foot shot and even pushing like a 410 foot shot. So I do have, like you said, that golf distance where it's not really going to blow you away, but I can still find myself out driving some top level players on occasion when I do choose to kind of like stretch it out a little bit.
I was a little surprised about was watching you throw this weekend. And then there was a few times where it's, like Kristen Tatar is known as a pretty far thrower, and you were walking up like 20 feet in front of her disc. I'm like, wow, like that's just... And you didn't look like you threw it hard. It's not like you threw a big flex shot. You didn't throw, you just threw a really solid, you have a very compact form and you were out driving Kristen Tatar quite a bit. And even Holland Hanley once in a while.
Yeah. And I have a friend at home, Stuart, who likes to say I have sneaky distance, where you wouldn't really expect it watching me throw, but then all of a sudden you'll see me park a 450 foot hole somehow. And you're like, how did she do? Where did that come from? You know? And so I guess, you know, back to the course a little bit, I really loved it. The whole atmosphere of the course was really fantastic. You had the moss hanging from the trees, you had clovers everywhere, and I liked the lines. But I think some of my criticisms could be that some of the shots were I guess I was hearing people say they were a little bit repetitive. So some of the longer holes, it was kind of, you know, stretch out a distance shot and then you've got to approach down there. So I think there maybe could have been a little bit more diversity in some of the holes for a little bit more like score separation, I think. And the mound holes were a little different.
Okay, someone asked about those.
They're hard because
someone said,
because if you're not within, if you're not right at the base of the hill, it felt like everybody laid up. So it was really approach dependent. I watched, you know, we saw Owen hit a really nice long putt. I think we saw Tatar hit one as well. But I think you laid up everyone that I recall seeing. I believe you laid up right under, you know, right to the base of the pin.
I laid up for bogey. I ain't messing around with none of that. Whoop, 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 whoop. None of that business. No, not for me. So that first one I thought was really interesting because it was weird because I wish I would have looked at the stats, but I don't think anyone two'd that hole. So everyone was either laying up for a three or a four, or running their putts and not successfully making their comeback or making their initial putt. So that one, I think, definitely could use some adjustments. I think it would be fun to, if you maybe just scooch the tee pad a little bit closer and made it a little bit more like you can run for the birdie with your drive. And then you've got like an intense comebacker putt for your birdie or for your par if you miss the green. And I mean, I'm no expert in course design, you know, that's my humble opinion. But I think that one could have been changed up a little bit.
Well, and to back up, I guess what you're saying, as Billy on the board is saying, there were no birdies for FPO on either holes all weekend. So that is a piece of, you know, analytical feedback or data that you could go back and look at and say, hey, you know, was it only birdied once or twice, or was it rarely birdied, as opposed to, you know, the distribution that you're looking for, you know, when it comes to good holes. That's something that could be, you know, improved upon or at least reviewed and then see if changes need to be made. Yeah. So yeah,
and
that
I
makes
mean,
perfect
there
sense.
There were plenty of birdies, you know, out there on the course too. So it's not like, you know, I necessarily needed another short birdie shot, but I think considering I want to say that's hole 10. So it's like right in that middle chunk of the round where you're kind of, at least in my mind, I'm kind of transitioning to, you know, how am I going to finish the round? So after hole 9, it's kind of that subtle shift to, okay, I've got, you know, 8 more to play. I've got, you know, these many opportunities to get a handful of strokes, and then kind of that, you know, classic finish strong mentality of like, you know, keep trucking for the next, you know, 4 or 5 holes, and then, you know, finish strong on that final kind of gauntlet, I would say, with, you know, 16, 17 and 18, maybe not so much 16, but I think that's a nervy hole considering it is right before 17 and 18. And it's this kind of like, hey, I'm a birdie right here. Don't you want to get this final, you know, easy ish two, kind of a, you know, throw it down the gap and have it finish. Not a incredibly technical shot, but still you have to execute that shot. So that was actually interesting. And then kind of moving on to the second mound hole, I think that one played better. I think that one definitely encouraged you to either, you know, go for max distance off the tee and try and run the green, you know, on your second shot and, you know, pray that you stick onto the mound and maybe you get that three. So I think that one played pretty well just in terms of challenging people's decision making and aggression. And so that one didn't play too bad, but I also did notice that almost everyone was either laying up to the base of the mound or unsuccessfully running the green from their tee shot and ending up kind of inadvertently laying up anyway, basically. And then you just kind of pitch it up to the basket and that was it. So, I mean, really minor things, you know, otherwise the course really played really well. I thought it was a really nice venue. It was honestly a pretty beautiful oasis, kind of a respite from the hustle and bustle of Houston that you can kind of find. There's just so much going on in every nook and cranny of that city. So to go through, you know, I left an hour early from my Airbnb and I was only 35 minutes away from the course, but I had no idea what was going to happen. There was one day where we got stopped at two different trains and they literally weren't even moving. They're just stopped on the tracks. So I made sure I was like an hour and a half early for every tea time. So it was really nice to go from these kind of super busy streets and really aggressive drivers and all of this hustle and bustle to all of a sudden you pull into the parking lot and you get out and you hear birds chirping and you kind of hear the breeze blowing through the trees. And it was just this interesting little oasis that they kind of have in Houston where there's just clovers everywhere. And it's just I thought it was a really beautiful, beautiful course. And it was a pleasure to play, you know, despite some of my, you know, minor criticisms.
So, per the board and per what you just said, it sounds like I have to ask, well, did you find any catnip? Apparently that you have a cat on tour with you, or what's the story there?
So it's a pretty funny story. So during a practice round at Waco, I was with Erica Stinchcomb and, I can't remember his last name, but it was a really cool photographer named Kevin. And we're just kind of chatting up and having a fun practice round. And we all release our tee shots on hole 15. We approach our tee shots and we're looking at the basket to line up our approaches. And all of a sudden we kind of like look forward and then we look at each other and then we kind of look forward and we're like, is that a cat literally on the green, like right next to the basket? Is that what, are you seeing this too?
Not cat merch, so, not cat Allen, an actual cat.
Yeah. A feline.
Okay. A feline. Okay.
Yeah. And so, and it was funny cause I look over at Erica and she said the funniest thing. She's like, well, I'm not throwing my approach now. There's a cat next to the basket. I'm definitely not doing that and risking hitting a cat. And so we all just picked up our lies and approached the cat as you kind of normally would, a little bit slowly, you know, and not trying to like startle this cat or anything like that. And we approach it and we're like, you know, doing all the little cat noises and cooing at it and stuff like that. And it's just this tiny, tiny little kitten, maybe anywhere between 6 months and a year old, but I wouldn't say more than a year old. And he literally just walks right up to us and starts like rubbing up against our legs and rubbing up against our ankles and like walking around. And so like, I'm literally looking at this cat. I'm a cat person, if you can't tell. And I'm like, I don't need a cat. I don't need a cat. My dad has a cat. My mom has two cats. I have a cat and two dogs at home, not my dogs, but my boyfriend's parents has two Jack Russells. So like I've got plenty of animals in my life and I'm picking up this cat and I'm looking at him like, like, are you going to take it? What are we going to do right now? And Erica's husband was like, I don't think we can't do a cat. Erica's slightly allergic. And her husband was like, nah. And the other guy on the card, Kevin, definitely didn't want a cat, didn't need a cat. So then all of a sudden I'm like, well, guess I have a cat now. I have to figure out how to deal with that. And so I went through Central Texas Pets Lost and Found, and I went through a couple of Facebook pages, posted a handful of pictures. I checked local vets and shelters. I got him scanned for a chip. No chip, not neutered, just a natural boy that somehow ended up on the disc golf course. And I've speculated, you know, how he got there, but there's no real knowing. You know, he could have been a farm cat that, you know, scooched over to the disc golf course. Someone could have, you know, ditched him at the park, which kind of happens all the time. Unfortunately, when you have a litter of kittens, you just kind of spread them around. And so when we were on the course, I'm just looking around and there's a really busy road right next to B East. There's turkey vultures everywhere in Waco. And so I just, there was just no way I was going to leave that cat around. And so I spent the week trying to see if someone could foster him or, you know, see if I could home him somehow. And I'm sure a disc golfer would have taken him, but the little guy just won my heart. He was so cool. And he ended up, to kind of like flashback a little bit, not to make the story too long, but he like followed us through like 7 holes. He followed us through the end of the round, basically. And we kind of coaxed him a little bit and was like, you know, come here, you know, come this way. But he literally just followed us through and was like, hey, I don't know that I need a home, but I kind of need a home and you guys are nice. So I'm going to follow you guys because I know what's good for me. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up taking him back to my campsite and we put him into my Prius and we're like, hopefully he doesn't hate car rides. We're going to figure this out. So we mm-hmm. put him in the car and we drive to Walmart and get our groceries for the day or whatever. And then we come back to the car and he's literally fallen asleep with like his face half smushed on a bag of chips. So we come back to the car and he's just asleep. The most relaxed, chill cat you could ever imagine. I got him a harness at Walmart and I put the harness on him and he doesn't love it, but he doesn't hate it.
What cat so does?
He does the thing, yeah, where he's like, this thing weighs like 10 pounds and I can't move with this harness on or whatever. Uh-huh. So then I got a leash for him and I started leash training him and he took to it immediately, like no fuss, no fighting whatsoever. So he just like, he's born to be a road cat, basically. And I got a little box from the dollar store, filled it with a little bit of litter and was like, here. And he's like, oh, cool. Thanks. Boop, boop. And completely litter trained. So nice, just like in every way that you can imagine, like a cat being the perfect travel cat, he basically is. I think I could probably even show you. He's just like,
yeah, we saw him a little bit walking back and forth there, but
He's just taking a nap on boxes right now.
You came out of Texas with a pro tour win, a belt buckle, and a cat.
Yeah, and an ace.
Yeah.
Although technically,
yeah. How does life get any better?
Yeah.
How does life get any better? Come on.
You kind of said it, man. Like, and I kind of touched on it before, you know, if these are the only highlights that I have for the year and I don't do anything spectacular for the rest of the tour, I doubt it, but man, I'm going to be pretty content and pretty happy with my performance so far. And just kind of, I my heart is pretty full right now.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a perfect way to end our conversation. Wow. It's been so awesome to hear everything that you've experienced already this year. Like you said, already exceeding your expectations, already 4-for-4 on cashing in a year you just hope to maintain and get by. And here you are with a win in your back pocket, a cat that's already litter trained and heading back for some relaxation and rest so that you can get ready for when the tour picks back up on the West Coast in just 3.5-4 weeks, whatever it's going to be for you. We are, I think the entire world is as happy for you as you should be for yourself and along with your family and the pride that should go along with everything you've accomplished here in the early part of 2023. Is there anything you want to say to the rest of the world? Any sponsors, ways that people can continue to support you? Give all your sign-offs and plugs and support and social media handles and such.
Well, I'll be brief but corny, but I really definitely want to express my gratitude for my dad and my mom and my brother, who's Prius. I am traveling in so much gratitude for my boyfriend, who just absolutely makes me feel free to go travel and do the things that I love. So, you know, thank you to Sterling and I definitely a shout out to my best friend, Melody, who is dealing with a little bit of personal struggle with some cancer in her life. But I wasn't able to say it before, but I kind of, you know, wanted to dedicate that win to her since she's going through so many things. And so just so much gratitude for, you know, Team High Country, the team that I'm a part of back home, who's doing fundraising for me at local putting leagues and putting together fundraising tournaments, and everyone who is donating discs for me to raffle off to rally funds. My boyfriend is, you know, raffling every other weekend to help support me. And so that I just definitely wanted to express gratitude for the amazing people in my life. And I can't even express enough gratitude for Westside kind of taking a little bit of a chance on me and giving me the financial support that I needed this year to accomplish the incredible things that I have done in the last, you know, 4.5 weeks. So Westside Discs is just an incredible piece to my successes this year and to my ability to travel. So I have so much gratitude for them. And you can keep an eye out for the release of a Westside Tournament X Bear with a really, really beautiful Psy Lotus stamp on it that's coming out on April 13th. I'm really excited about it. I was super picky about the logo and was like, can we change this? Can we change this? And so they worked with me and I was so excited with how it turned out. And as I said before, you can follow me on Instagram at Psy Parananda. You can follow me on Facebook if you'd like to. The link in my bio on Instagram will take you to the Westside page where you can pick up my commemorative Texas State Championship disc. And I have already received an overwhelming amount of support with my tour series discs, or not my tour series discs, but the Dymax discs that have come out so far. So thank you so much to everyone who has bought the Wu-Tang disc. You guys are overwhelmingly incredible. It's absolutely insane. I'm sure I could talk for another 10 minutes about, you know, of the gratitude I feel and then the people support me. But I think that pretty much summarizes it, you know?
Awesome. Well, again, we of course are super happy for you. It's been a heck of a ride in the FPO division this year and seeing stars like yourself show up on a weekend like this and talk about trending in the right direction. I see you, you know, 25th to 9th now, you know, to first place. And like you said, just picking up those lessons in the first couple of events in the first couple of weeks to then have it all compile and then, you know, culminate on a weekend like this for you. The entire world loves it. And we just can't say it enough. Congratulations. Get the rest, travel safely, get the rest and the, you know, restoration and everything else that you need when you get back and make all those connections again. And we're looking forward to seeing what else you're going to do here in 2023 and beyond. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope that this is only the beginning.
I guarantee you we will have you on again.
Yes, we love it.
I would be happy to.
All right. Love to you and your father. Travel safely. Get home safely. And again, we'll see you probably in the next few weeks when you get back on the tour. We'll see you then.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thanks, a great night.
All right. Take care. See ya. Bye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Terry, I truly think it takes a special person to be able to take the shine away from Owen Scoggins on the weekend, because everybody roots for Owen. I mean, she is one of the most charismatic people out on tour, but this weekend, I truly felt that everybody was rooting for Sai. And it wasn't just spectators. I think, based on some of the social media posts, I think some of the pros, maybe that weren't necessarily in it, were rooting for Sai to win as well. Because she's kind of a known commodity. As she said, she hasn't been on tour, but she's been around the scene off and on. And we could tell just from this interview her her passion for life in general. So I think watching that, if, again, I know I'm a sucker for Owen Scoggins winning just on multiple levels, but I was rooting for Sai, hands down. After that first round, it was like, cool, let's go. I want to see Sai win. And it was a pretty amazing weekend, to be honest.
Yeah, congratulations. As she said, so many things that she's learned. And then what is that, six different winners? In FPO that we've seen. I mean, what is that? You know, we've talked for years about dominance and or a lack of parity within the division, because it's always, well, was it Paige or Kat or Hokum? You know, for so many years, it felt like those were the only two or three on any given weekend. And now clearly we're proving any and every given weekend we have different contenders. I think Paige was, of course, in the field, and she said how she was so excited to see it unfold this weekend. So congratulations yet again. Like you said, impossible. It feels impossible not to root for her. And you know, everything she said here tonight just backs that up. It was awesome to see. So yeah, and dare I say, I mean, what a weekend then, in a sense, in a similar sense, similar but different sense, of course, for Westside, in that on the other, at another big event taking place, again, selfishly when I was covering, but on the MPO side, playing for Westside, another big fan favorite in Matty O, and him taking down this weekend as well. So all in all, not a bad weekend for Team Westside.
Yeah, both of their top players on their team. What is their team called? It's got to be something clever, I'm sure. The Warlords. The Warlords are the top level team of Westside. There's only two of them. It's Matty O and Sayananda.
Okay.
So
getting
two wins in a weekend is great for any manufacturer, and especially a smaller. It's funny because we consider Westside like just a smaller entity, when now they are a part of this much bigger entity, possibly the biggest one in disc golf, but they are a subset of that. So it's pretty exciting it's got to be exciting for them to see that they made some bets over the last year or two and they're paying off.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of which, I'm going to jump right into just a couple of the results that we saw over at the 18th Open at Tallahassee, sponsored by Visit Tallahassee. Just when you thought the event name over in Texas was a long one. Technically, this one probably challenges it in terms of the overall characters. But on the FPO side, we'll stick with that train of FPO division. When it was all said and done, Morgan Linz held off her twin sister, Jordan Linz, to take down the A-tier victory. So Morgan, even though her sister, Jordan, you look at the last two holes between the two of them on 17 and 18, Jordan picked up three strokes to cut the deficit from six down to three. She picked up three strokes in the last two holes, but it didn't matter. Morgan would go on to be your champion. And then finishing also on the podium in the third spot was Florida's own Ellen Widboom. And I think literally all seven of the FPO competitors from the Open at Tallahassee, I will see in a couple days here at the Throwdown the Mountain, which is another story. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, some stories relating to that. But I think all seven of those same women we will see. Let me just double check real quick.
Is there any talk of the Linz twins going out on tour? Or are they kind of sticking with Florida? I mean, they took, second and third at Am Worlds last year behind Cadence, right?
Cadence yeah, Urge. So that is something maybe I'll find out more this weekend. That I do not know off the top of my head. And just to say it, there was seven women in this weekend's event at Tallahassee. I think all seven of them are playing at Throwdown the Mountain, and then there's five additional women. So there's a total of 12 women in the FPO field this weekend at Throwdown the Mountain, but we'll talk about that later. So anyway, one final time, Morgan Linz, your champion. Congratulations to her. Jordan Linz, her sister, taking second, and Ellen Widboom taking third. So that's what you saw on the FPO side. On the MPO side, I say it all the time, one of my favorite parts about going to tournaments that aren't just on the silver, what is it even called? It's not the Silver Series. So it's what?
It's just a silver event.
Silver. Okay. The silver event. The silver event and the elite events is getting to see so many of these other next up and coming superstars. And a few of them that come to mind that I've seen sometimes in the past and we'll see more of. Braden Sides, who I ultimately talked to and filmed. Aiden Scott, whose name I spelled wrong, but I saw him. Dylan Sepala. These are players that we're going to see in the next year, two, three, 5 years. And then they're going to be out on the tour where they're going to be playing more regularly and we're going to see them on lead cards. And I'm going to be like, oh yeah, I saw that guy in Tallahassee. I saw how he handled himself. You know, those are the kinds of things that I get so excited about seeing. But when it was all said and done, none other than Team Westside, the warlord himself, I think is that you, as you've referenced, Matteo Oram, did take this down. It did feel like it was his to win. He did have a sizable, again, it's always just on paper, but he did have a pretty healthy margin when it came to just straight up player ratings when you looked at him for the weekend. And I was going to say he was rated 1040 coming into the weekend, and his next closest competitor was rated 1019, Silas Schultz at 1018, and then a lot of 1018s to, you know, so on and so forth. So coming into it on paper, he was definitely a favorite. And when it was all said and done, well, he came out ahead. So congratulations to him. He shot 1055, 1043, and 1037 golf. So just a little bit above his rating. And to talk about the top five or so-ish spots, again, Oram, your champion. Silas Schultz ended up finishing in second after a great second and third round. Mediocre first round, really charged hard in rounds two and three. Casey White, who had, again, a mediocre first round, charged back pretty hard in the final round to get the third podium spot. So Oram, Silas Schultz, Casey White, and then Sullivan Tipton in fourth, tied along with Braden Sides. They finished in a tie for fourth. Aiden Scott in sixth, along with Mark Chapalonis from the vlogs. D.W. Haas and Randy Deck? Duke? We're going to go with Randy Deck. Finished eighth, and then a two-way tie for 10th with Dylan Sepala, as I mentioned, and Matthew Alexander. So top 10, open at Tallahassee. And here, aside from the great play and the incredible park, the historic park that everybody loves and the layout, we saw this for the Silver Series last year. My best guess, and go ahead and, you know, mark it on your tapes, because that's what you do, or put it on your calendars. I wouldn't be surprised if we see another promotion back to either a silver or an elite series for the Open at Tallahassee. I mean, I feel like they're doing everything right. Mm-hmm. and it's probably just a matter of timing.
Well, to didn't get you figured say out.
That's my guess.
One of your social media posts, they had 20,000 in added cash.
20,000.
That's
added
a
cash.
Pretty good start to at least get on as a silver event. And that's not enough to be a pro tour event, but if you're able to start with 20,000 and you're just an A tier or whatever they happen to be, and I'm throwing just in quotes there because being an A tier is a lot of work. Yeah, it wouldn't shock me to see some more Florida established pro tour events, because we'll get into the conversation right now. Next weekend is Throw Down the Mountain, which has been talked about as a possibility for a silver event for a few years now, run by Mike Barnett. And this week, the big news was that Paul McBeth purchased the property along with Dylan Cease, the MLB pitcher who is going to be opening day for the White Sox, easily one of the top five pitchers in the league right now, who happens to be an avid disc golfer, a friend of Paul. So we now have this Throw Down the Mountain venue that hopefully will become a permanent course. And I think that is, if Paul has his way, which he usually gets, my guess is that this might become a stop. Whether it's a silver event, whether it's going to be a pro tour, I don't know, and I haven't been there. I've only seen it on footage. I don't know if it could be a pro tour event based on the course, but it feels like it would be a really good silver event. But who knows? Things could change now that we own the property. And when I say we, I mean we as a community.
We as in you, Dylan, and Paul.
As in I didn't invest anything in it, but... I'm glad you locked
contribution.
Up. I'm glad you locked up because nobody needed to hear whatever you said.
All right. Am I back now?
Yes.
Okay. Have numbers been made to the purchase of that? And I asked that in, we were on the Nick and Matt show last night. I ain't got time for that. But they probably, I'm sure, spilled some information and or provided some. And I'm just wondering, Citizen X is saying 1.6.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm not going to share anything that I don't know if is or isn't shareable at the moment. But yes, someone's saying over a milli. Is there a milli? 1.3. Sure. So people are just making up random numbers now. Because 1.6 and 1.3 and then over a milli are all...
I mean, that's all over a milli, right?
They said 1.2. Somebody said 60 acres, 1.6 million. Okay, so lots of people are talking about 1.2 million. Over $1 million, obviously. And I don't know what they said last night, so I'm just going to go on what I believe. I don't think there's any doubt. Well, let's back up. They could do whatever they want with the property in theory. So like there's a course and there's been 6 or 8 or 10 or 29 iterations of the course. If you ever go out there with Greg Hosfeld, he'll tell you where every pin and every basket's ever been.
No,
because
please.
He was one of the original. He was one of the original designers out there and one of the guys that made it all happen, I believe, from way back in the day. So, and if you play with any old school people, someone like a Charlie Goodpasture or whomever, again, everyone will tell you where every pin's ever been. I think I could map them out, and I've only been there for a few years. So anything is possible. I mean, there's clearly a course that we're going to see this weekend that has become kind of the final version of the course that we've seen for Throw It on the Mountain, and then a slightly scaled back version of it for some of the lesser skilled divisions. That's been particular to Throw Down the Mountain and to Mike Barnett and Sun King. In theory, we all know now that they own the property, Dylan and Paul could go out there literally with bulldozers and do whatever they want with it. So what version of the course will we see and is possible may or may not be at all like what it is today. And as people are talking about it, 63 acres, 60 acres, whatever the case is, somewhere in that neighborhood, there's a lot of property out there that is not being used for disc golf as we speak. I mean, a lot. I mean, you as you roam around out there, if you're a disc golfer and you're roaming around out there, it'd be weird if you were not, unless you're one of the cows, I guess. If you're roaming around out there, you're like, oh, this would be a good spot for a hole. Or oh, hey, this could be a tee or this could be a pin. There is a ton of that out there. And I'm sure Paul, throughout the last decade, has had plenty of those very thoughts. In fact, we've talked about some of those. So a course of any caliber and design could then happen. And just to bring this full circle, I think one of the challenges that way, one of the many reasons why we maybe haven't seen this as a Silver Series or on the Pro Tour, A, cell phone signal has traditionally kind of sucked out there. And B, which obviously then prohibits live. And then B, because it's been rented property for all these years, we haven't seen permanent tee pads put in, like cement tee pads. We haven't seen a permanent structure of that sort. And they're essentially temporary tee pads. And one of the primary basics for our Elite Series events and our PDGA majors and so on and so forth are a certain degree of tee pad of whatever that is. But they have to have tee pads that are of a certain standard. Mm-hmm. And that's just a commitment that someone on a temporary renting the property for a 4 or 6 week basis that Mike Barnett and Sun King have done for the last decade has not been a practical solution for them to do. Now, again, when this land can be used exclusively for disc golf, all of those options are now put on the table. And you're talking about a couple of guys that have a little bit of money in the bank that could then be able to afford to do so and make it practical. And I think there's options of, you know, if this becomes either free or pay to play or a membership based scenario, whatever the case might be, it's now going to be a permanent disc golf course that just opens up a million more possibilities on the property. And I think that should be the most exciting thing for all of disc golf, is just the fact that everything's now on the table. So after that dialogue or that monologue, I wonder if there's anything that's been said that maybe I either misunderstood or contradicted from what was said last night. But Tim's on the board saying they were talking about a lifetime membership for $2,500. Ryan saying he sees a future where the Pro Tour starts in Florida. You know, here's another challenge that I know personally. This is kind of just outside of the town or city of Brooksville. This is essentially an old quarry, you know, and cow pasture right now. There's not running water on the property. There's not electricity on the property. Like, there's clearly infrastructure. Whatever ends up going there is one thing, but infrastructure is going to need to be established out on the property. And so those are things that I think a lot of people either don't know or don't realize, but that's going to be part of this overall process. So I'm excited to see what the future has. I'm excited to see how, you know, an event like Throw Down the Mountain and Sun King, how that relationship continues and in what form that continues and what they're doing. I'm excited to see all of the possibilities, but you've got two guys that love disc golf that do have a little bit of money. I think anything's possible.
Did they get any cows with the purchase?
That's a good question.
I mean, they got the land.
You know, you can stick your head up a cow. I don't know. But I'll find that out by the end of the weekend. And real quickly, you speak of cows, I'll speak of goats. Ken Climo was out on the property yesterday and ultimately celebrated birthday. So happy birthday to
55.
Ken.
55.
Barry Schultz, of course, one of his biggest competitors and adversaries for you know, better part of a couple decades, celebrates a birthday today. So happy birthday to Barry Schultz today. But Kenny was out here, and the rumor was that he had a little newfound excitement, maybe in his voice just about the idea that it's staying this property, which he's of course very familiar with as well, and has competed here for, you know, a number of times. it's staying within disc golf because it was about to be lost to a non-disc golf entity to maybe never have another event at it again, or for certainly to never have another event at it again, just to hear that this property, which has become very special to Florida and Florida disc golfers, that it's going to remain within disc golf and it's going to be in the hands of Paul and Dylan. So yeah, it's just really cool. And I know, Johnny, you would have a slightly different air of excitement and enthusiasm once you get down here and see sure. that it's just become a really special place. And I selfishly can say that because I've been here now for this will be my ninth throw down the mountain out mm-hmm. of the 11, I think, that they've had. This will be my ninth year in a row of being here for it. So I've certainly experienced, you know, so much of that magic and beauty that the Florida disc golfers have as well. I mean, this is now an event that I think is spread out over 6 weekends. So 4 weekends mm-hmm. of play over 6 total weeks where this course is available. Can you think of a more, I don't want to say spread out, but can you think of a more encompassing or a larger scale magnitude single event, Johnny?
No, I would be curious to know how many total players that is.
We could do some math.
I'm not going to do math. Smart could. No.
But anyway, no, I mean, he's selling out every weekend.
Correct.
You know, and, you know, so you think about that, you know, some people run one or two big tournaments a year. He's essentially running, you know, a big tournament for 4 out of 6 weekends, all on a temporary course without electricity or water. I mean, you know, hats off to Sun King and Mike Barnett. So, and I'm not just saying that because he's going to pay me.
But he is going to pay you, right?
But I think he is going to pay me. So,
well, let's keep the news
anyway
in the southeastern portion of our country, and we're going to move up just a little bit to Appling, Georgia. The Champions Cup announced. I guess technically, I think the announcement was today, but yesterday you could see on the registration that the Champions Cup opened up 12 more spots, 8 in MPO.
Am I in now?
4 in FPO. No, Terry, you just barely missed the cut. But they're not just going to open up to the next people on the wait list. It is going to be play-ins.
What? Okay, what? So I'm basically in.
You're basically, in. I mean, just get down there, play WR
Where's
Jackson.
Where's the first tee and what's the saying? Where's the first tee and what's the course record?
And what's the course record? That's right.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
So we've got... And the play-ins are only open to the people who were on the wait list, I believe, when they opened up. So that's 26 or 27 MPO, and I believe 9 or 10 FPO. There were 16 touring pros on that wait list. 16. Mm. Half of them are not getting in. I have to wonder how many are going to bother showing up to play in. Just... If you are, and I'm not picking on him, Casey White,
who
finished third this weekend, but if you're not in the area, we'll say now he's different because he'll probably be in the area. He tours.
He's technically there today, but that's another story.
Exactly. But if you weren't in the area, would you travel out of your way to go there? You know, and I know Casey has actually been practicing that course pretty religiously over the last few weeks. And he did last year as well. He went there real early last year, according to one of the interviews I listened to from him. But anyway, would you bother going? Knowing that if you're not James Conrad, if you're not Kevin Jones, there's a good chance you're not getting in. And the second question is are some of those big guys not going to get in? Are we going to, because WR Jackson is a course where you could go out and shoot a couple under par. You could go out and shoot a couple over par. And your round didn't feel that different. It's heavily wooded. It's long. There's a lot of danger to get into. I'm actually, I'll say I'm excited to know who does and doesn't get in. But I'm also disappointed that it had to come to this for some of our pros, as we discussed last week. So it's going to be fun.
Well,
it's going to be fun to hear people chatter about this.
Well, and just right off the bat, for starters, I take a look at the wait list, which I'm going to put in the chat for anyone that cares to look. As I'm looking at it, some of these people are I'll say, more obvious. And first of all, like you said, if you're on the road and you're touring and it's logically, it's a 4-hour trip for you, that maybe is a no brainer, mm-hmm. right? That it's no big deal. Of course, I want to play in the major. I'm going to drive the 4 hours I'm trying to get in. Somebody who might be more than that or says, well, if I don't get in that, then maybe I take 2 or 3 straight weeks off. You know, they'll have to obviously wrestle with that decision on their own. But then you look at a few of the people, like, I just think right off the top of my head, someone like a Matt Dollar or an Evan Scott who lives in South Carolina. Some of these people that are like, it's not quite their backyard, but it's kind of their backyard. They seem like a no-brainer, like, oh, well, I'm going to for sure go try. Now, will I'm trying to think of somebody who's maybe kind of sort of on the tour-ish. You know, Ben Wolf, I don't know where Ben lives or Ben is out of. But like you said, will he then still go take his shot? Yeah, maybe. There's so many other people that I think are for sure going to, though. I mean, you got to assume Aaron Gossage, Ezra Aderholt, Andrew Marwee, Double G, Andrew Presnell, Kevin Jones, Austin Hannum, James Conrad, Nate Perkins, Luke Humphreys, Noah Meinsma. Those guys are all, Casey White, Tim Barr. Those guys are all on the tour. You have to assume they're going to. They built it into their tour schedule, maybe prematurely, but they built it into their tour schedule. You have to assume they're planning on it. Yeah. So, it's a great question. And then you said 4 spots in FPO?
There are 4 spots in FPO out of the 6 people. I thought there was 8.
5.
But there's...
Now it should, well, as of right now, it shows 5 women on the waiting list. And I do not know Silva... Saarinen. Otherwise, you have Leah Sinigini, Haley Childs, who lives right there, Jessica Weiss, and Emily Beach. So 4 of them, you know, are 3 of them are touring players. I do not know Silva personally, and Haley Childs, I know, lives nearby, but isn't necessarily a touring player, but would likely still come give her a shot at earning her way in. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
It wouldn't, yeah, I guess. I said it wouldn't shock me if one of those FPO didn't make it in or didn't even bother to show up and then all 4 of them just get in. That would not shock me either.
As I'm guessing Carney is either being funny or not, but yeah, someone initially said, is there going to be 5 on a card? Or Carney had said hole 18 and hole 18A and 18B plus ghost cards. No, none of that. None of that silliness. We said it last week, when there's effing rain out there and everything is delayed by 1 hour and then the whole thing gets,
a whole round gets cut out
or a round, or some people have to complete a round the next morning and blah, blah, blah. And we run out of daylight. I'm not going to say I told you so. And I know
a rain delay
could be 30 minutes or it could be, or it could be 4 hours and it is what it is, but the more you push it, if it's close,
right? I can guarantee you, you're going to get an "I told you so" from Terry Miller. Count it.
We're officially playing with fire at that point, right?
We are.
So anyway, all right. So that was announced what today you're saying or yesterday now, or recently?
I believe the actual announcement went out today, but I did see the spots open up yesterday on the wait list and I had gotten some inside information, which is why I made the joke last week with Paige Pierce to maybe not necessarily count on Nate Perkins because I knew that they were going to be opening up.
He may attempt to qualify.
He may attempt to qualify.
Or maybe, as Paige said, maybe he's 100% committed to caddying and he removes himself from even attempting to qualify. I mean, that's obviously possible too.
So. Oh, 100%. That could happen.
All right.
I wonder if it's going to be a cost. I wonder if they're going to charge them or if it's just like, hey, here's qualifying spots. You're on the wait list.
Kind of like USDGC has like the initial like $50 fee.
Hell yeah. I'd milk them for another $50 to $70. I call it a stupid tax.
Make a donation to some kind of charity. then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care where the money goes. I just say you milk them for some money and call it a, you know, a tax, a silly tax, a brainless tax, a not clicking fast enough tax.
You know, some of them did, some of them didn't. All right. Well, I guess we will see how this all shakes out. Looking forward to it. Let's take a quick look. I didn't know if there was, obviously it felt like everyone's mind was on one of those two events that we just talked about this last weekend, being Tallahassee and Texas. Was there anything else out there that,
the only other news, and this was yesterday. Yeah. Yesterday. Cause it was my mother's birthday. It made me reminded me, the world's registration opened up. And did you see, Terry, who the very first person to register was? Number one.
Was it like James Conrad?
Or it was Ezra Aderhold. It was close.
Ezra. Okay.
Ezra, who was on the wait list for Champions Cup. So he was the very first person to register when it opened. So congratulations to Ezra. Number one on the board and in our hearts. But ultimately, there the world's registration is now open. And the world's invite list was also posted. Now, this is obviously a little different because, and I'm going to drop a little bit of PDGA knowledge on you that I didn't know until last week.
Oh, gosh.
You might already know it, Terry. There was a big discussion as to why the PDGA didn't email everybody for Champions Cup. Like, hey, why not email anybody? The PDGA actually has a policy about that that says events cannot email players unless they're invited to a tournament. And for Champions Cup, there was only 20 or 30 people that were invited, I think, out of, because it's an early, it's still pretty young. So I think I could be wrong with the 20 or 30 number. Maybe it's as much as 40. I don't know. But so those people got invites. Now for Worlds, I believe the world invite list is much longer, which is why a lot more emails went out. And my understanding is the PDGA has a policy about the emailing to help cut down on potential abuse and spam of their members. Because the last thing you want is, the last thing I want is another email from Terry Miller just because I registered for an event, or maybe I'm in his area. He's asking people for money. Hey, do you guys have any sponsorships or things like that? I mean, because that's what some tournament directors would probably do. Now, maybe
some
they wait.
Do. Some in Wisconsin have apparently abused this spamming policy already. I won't name any names.
Not you. So that is the reason why the announcement went out the way it did. That's why they don't email. Now, that might change in the future. That's going to be, I'm sure all this stuff now is on the table. They're going to talk to about it. Should there be an exception for majors? I could understand that. Like, It's there's so few of them. PDGA is running them. I could see an exception to where the PDGA does email out everybody who has qualified, not just invited, but qualified for this to alert them. But that is the current reason why the PDGA doesn't do that. It's going to require a policy change at the PDGA spot. So my guess is it'll probably be something that's discussed at the next meeting of the PDGA Minds, and things will happen. And I don't know what that is, because I do not have any insider info. I just figured I would share that information with everyone out on the board to know why some of those things don't happen. It is to help cut down on abuse of your email by tournament directors. So
there's one thing I like to abuse. It's maybe not email. No, I don't.
Nah.
Okay. Well, that is good to know. And it is funny. Someone had just posted something about, and I don't know exactly the full context, but they said something to how ancient of a system where you have to register. And if talking about a tournament, I don't consider that "quote unquote" ancient at all. I mean, let's be real. Someone, let's put it this way: you won an event last year. That qualified you to play in the Champions Cup this year. What if your life's different? You're not on tour. You're injured. Like, there's a million reasons why you may not come to this tournament. that maybe on the other side of the country or in another, because you won a freaking event in Estonia.
Sai, I don't think you all, Ananda. Sai Ananda.
I just don't think you should
not coming to this event. She just literally won an event. She played okay last year. She took top 10 at USWDGC. You would think she's in the top, you know, 50 women. She had no interest in going to this event based on her touring schedule. So,
say, well, you're registered. Thank you. You're back. Right. You're backing up my point. Like,
yeah,
you still have to show that you're,
yep,
you're interested and you're dedicated and you're putting forth the effort to show that you're coming to this event capacity, because otherwise, mm-hmm, if they just registered everyone that was eligible, well, then you'd have to scale back the eligibility considerably because you can't have 400 people registered for the event.
And then you have to adjust what your registration, yeah, policy is. You know, like I said, Manabu, who's the highest rated player. You've got Daryl Nodland, who's like a 10-30 something plus rated player who plays one event a year.
North Dakota, South Dakota, yeah.
Yeah, EMAC, who's still 10-30 rated, but who, congratulations, took second place at his first event in like a year at Texas State.
He's a world champ.
But he's a world champ. Should champ. You just be...
put him in the Hall of Fame. Give him a...
Yeah.
Just for signing up. I mean, like, there is this interesting notion, and I'm all about rewarding and thanking and providing some perks to some people for some reasons, but a lot of people want to stretch perks and not Nate Perkins want to stretch perks out to being 100 things deep in 100 different eligibilities. And if you fulfilled every one of those, then there's going to be special for any reason.
And as I've said, like, even if you automatically register somebody and you wait for them to say no, even if you automatically register somebody and you wait for them to say no, that doesn't change the issue that we had, which was the bad communication. If Ezra was registered for this and it went 2-3 weeks and no one heard from him, they pull him off the registration. There's no difference in what happened. That's my idea. Now, maybe the argument is, you know, you just lock in all these players. Every tour player gets locked in for X amount of time, but then we're going to have the issue. Do we have the problem still of, do we care if these events fill? That's really the next question. Do we care if there's 100 people playing or only 70? Those extra 30 that could fit, does it matter? I mean, do we care if the guy who's 999 rated, who waited there and waited there and waited there for to open up, if he plays? I don't know, because it used to be that those bottom people were all feeders for money to the top pros. You know, that's how we made a bunch of the money and made up for you know, the purse. That's less and less relevant now. Not that those don't still count, but if you take out 20 or 30 people at $350 a piece, you know, $6,000-$7,000 out of the purse on a, we'll just probably say a $75,000 purse is my guess, somewhere around there, maybe more than that. Maybe I'm miscounting, but I don't know. That's a whole nother question that we need to have.
Yeah. I mean, it depends, like, this, you're invited largely based on the fact of having wins or some other accreditation from the year or from the prior year, which is very different than how the USDGC does it. It doesn't have to be. And in theory, you could win 20 flex starts on the PGA, within the PGA, 20 flex starts, seed tiers in place with.
Yeah, Terry, I'm gonna
players at it on wins.
I'm cutting the video to you. I might just cut you completely because you're super choppy and it's almost totally impossible to understand what you're saying. So,
well, that's good.
There, I just cut video to you right now. So, but you're still here.
Oh,
maybe,
good.
Maybe
well,
that'll help.
Well, here, then I can do all sorts of things I shouldn't be doing here.
No, we can still see you. You can't see us now.
Oh, darn it. Internet. Okay. Anyway, point being, you know, all these majors have different criteria for how you qualify for them. And so we have one blanket statement or one blanket that covers all of them if we're going to continue to have diphtheria. USDGC's criteria to play is different than Worlds, which is different than the Cup. So straight ratings, whatever, there's just not one blanket scenario or solution.
Are you still there?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Well, with that, I don't have a problem cutting loose here. I'm an hour ahead of you guys, yeah, and I got a bunch of stuff to do anyway. Well, I guess with that, we're going to yet again thank Sayananda and congratulate her on her incredible performance this weekend. Congrats to her. Of course, congrats to Vinny, who took it down on the MPO side. And then here in Florida, seeing Morgan Linz take it down along with Matty O on the MPO side over at Tallahassee. Great weekend. If you guys aren't enjoying disc golf live or post-production, I don't know what the hell you're doing. But thank you guys so much for joining us tonight. Thank you to Cy for joining. And with that, I'm Terry Miller of the Disc Golf Guy, Johnny V, along with Cy. That was episode 448 of Smashbox. And I'm signing off. As next week when you step inside the Smashbox.
Thank you to our $2 and above patrons. Your name is listed below in the credits. If you are interested in being listed as a producer in the Smashbox TV credits and supporting this and other fine podcasts, please visit patreon.com/smashboxtv.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.